Hello and welcome to Inside Maine. This is Angus King, and this is a program where we talk to people about issues that are important to Maine and the country. And we're talking about one today that affects virtually every family in Maine and across the United States at some point in their lives. And the issue is family leave, paid family leave, having an opportunity to take a break when you have a sick child, a sick relative, or a senior that you need to take care of. And right now, believe it or not, the United States and I think New Guinea are about the only countries in the world that don't have a comprehensive paid family leave policy. So back in 2017, working with my friend and colleague Deb Fisher of Nebraska, we put together a bill that basically provides a tax credit to companies if they develop their own paid family leave programs. And with me this morning, I'm delighted to have Deb Fisher, who is a senator from Nebraska. She and I were elected the same year, and we work together practically every day now on the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee. I'm the chair, she's the vice chair, and these days we seem to be meeting almost every day and sometimes twice a day. Deb, welcome to Inside Maine. It's great to have you, and of course, it's always fun to work with you.
Oh, thank you, Angus. It is always such a pleasure to work with you, too. We did come into the Senate together, and I'm just very, very happy that we find so many different issues that we can work together on.
Well, tell me about what brought you to this issue of paid family leave. What was it that got your attention and got you to the place where you were ready to try to actually do something about it?
One of my main focuses throughout my public life has always been I've wanted to work hard for Nebraska families. I want to build a stronger Nebraska for the next generation. And part of that, a big part of that, means that we need to support strong families. And you were right in your introduction, there has been a void here in the United States when it comes to paid family leave. There are different policies out there, but I wanted to look for something that would really benefit smaller businesses, mom and pop businesses on Main Street, so they could offer their employees time off, as you said, to take care of a sick child, to check up on an elderly patient, to get your kids to a doctor's appointment. And that's been really hard, first of all, for those businesses that have maybe one or two employees. And we have those in Nebraska on our main streets. I know that you do in Maine as well. And the employees are hourly employees. And it's difficult for those workers to take time off. So we tried to tailor a policy, a new bill that would look at those folks that really need the help, the employees themselves and the businesses. And I think you and I came up with a great solution there, to offer a tax credit to the employers and then to target those hourly employees so that they could benefit.
I think that's really important. And I remember talking with you about this 5 years ago. And the problem is a lot of larger companies have their own kinds of programs, and the executives all get time off if they need it. But what we were trying to focus on was the frontline clerk in the grocery store or somebody that's out driving a truck. And I think that was what was sort of different about this proposal and one of the ways that we expressly wanted to design it. And I don't want to get all into the deep details of it, but basically, as you said, it's a tax credit. What it means is that an employer, if they offer paid family leave and there are specifications about how it would work and how many weeks and that kind of thing, then they get a credit on their taxes for a percentage of what they're paying out in family leave. And it's a tax benefit to them. Now, we passed this. This was passed in 17. By the way, this was the only, I think this is the only bipartisan family leave bill that's ever been extant around here, and I'm very proud of that.
You know, really, it's the only paid family leave bill that's in federal statute right now. It's the only one that's ever been passed. So I think that's something you and I, we can hang our hat on that. That, you know, first of all, we just really had a strong focus, but then we were able to get it done.
Well, and I think that's an important point. People who, you know, watch the news and cable news get the impression that we never get anything done around here. It's totally gridlocked. We can't work together. We don't like each other. And that's just not true. I mean, it's tough on some of these bigger issues, but every now and then we're able to do something. And there's no question that this got done because it was not one party or the other. It was, and that's the only way things get done around here. Now, the problem is that when we proposed this, it was temporary. It only went for a few years. We've extended it, but now we're trying to make it permanent. Why, Deb? Why is it important to make it permanent?
Well, we wanted to see, first of all, the way we set it up was to have a pilot program, basically, to have it a temporary program. I thought it was really important to be able to gather data on how many businesses would use it. Was it really an advantage to workers, especially, again, folks being able to take an hour or two off a day to go to school, check on their kids, stuff like that. And so we wanted to gather the information. But the problem that we had with it, it took over a year for the Treasury Department to come up with the rules that would govern the program. And then we did extend it to be able to gather information. But businesses didn't take advantage of it. And I don't blame a business for not taking advantage of it when it's not a permanent program. You know, to make that investment in your employee, to set up a whole new program for your business, and then what if it expires and it's not made permanent? That would be very difficult for both the employee and the business to try to figure out how they could make that continue to work without a tax credit to help them hire somebody else part-time to fill in for that employee. Just a number of those hard decisions that would have to be made. So I don't think we've had too many businesses take advantage of it, and I believe that there's just such a strong need out there that we need to make the program permanent. And we've made some adjustments to it in our bill, and I'm hopeful that we can get support, and you and I, Angus, should be able to get this done then, because people need it. People need it. You have obviously maternity leave that has to be covered for people that aren't covered in that now. You have to be able to look at giving a flexibility to families so that they can care for their children, so they can care for their partners, their spouses, their elderly parents. Things come up in our lives where you have to be able to take some time off. And you need to have that covered. You can't give up an hourly wage. You can't give up a salary in order to take on those family responsibilities and keep your family unit strong.
Well, exactly. We don't want people to have to make choices between taking a sick child to the doctor or being able to earn the money to put food on the table. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, and people were having to make those kinds of choices. And I, as I was listening, one of the things we've done here is listen. We've paid attention to what's happened out there, to companies that have worked in this field and have looked at the bill. And as you say, the problem that we encountered was because it wasn't permanent, it was a temporary program, a lot of companies said, well, we like this, but we're afraid if we incorporate this benefit and then the tax credit goes away, we'll be in the position of perhaps having to take a benefit away from our employees, and they didn't want to do that. So I think that's the main reason that we're now moving toward making it permanent. It's not a huge hit to the Treasury, but it's one that can really make a difference for families. And I should mention, because when you and I finish talking, Deb, I'm going to be talking to a fellow from the Alzheimer's Association in Maine, because it's not only in this day and age, it's probably almost as likely for someone to have to take time off to deal with a parent or a grandparent than with a child. And so that's why I want to talk to the Alzheimer's Association about what this would mean to them. The other thing that we learned that was a kind of oversight in the original bill is that there are insurance products that employers can buy to cover this, but the tax credit didn't help them with the insurance. In other words, it only worked if they paid it out of pocket. So we've tried to fix that in this draft as well, which will also increase the availability. So we're trying to do something important, which is to learn from the experience and build on it. And I think it's worth noting that perhaps one of the reasons we work so well together, Deb, is that our states are pretty similar, mostly rural with one or two urban areas. And it's just it's important, not only in Omaha or Portland, but in all the smaller towns in Nebraska and Maine.
Oh, definitely. And you and I both know that's where you see in many cases a lot of small businesses that are really the economic driver of those small communities. And I find it especially helpful, our bill. You mentioned the Alzheimer's Association. It's our bill supported by the Alzheimer's Association. It's supported by AARP. It's supported by NFIB. So we have a great support across the board because these associations understand, again, the importance of having flexibility for families, choices for families. And then as we move to the next step here in trying to get our bill passed, I think it'll be helpful that have worked on this together so long, Angus, and talked about it a lot here in the Senate. So hopefully we have a pretty good bipartisan support. We have outside stakeholders supporting it. And I just think now's the time that we can get this done.
Well, it is important, and I'm hopeful, because I'm sure our colleagues are hearing the same thing from their hometowns, and you and I don't know whether it was wisdom or good fortune struck upon a formula that seems to have bipartisan appeal, and that's the important thing. Before I lose you, Deb, I think it would be fun to share with the listeners work that we do together in another area that's about as far removed from paid family leave as it can be, and that is the Strategic Forces Subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee, which is all about the defense of the country and being sure that we're able to deter any potential adversary. And I think, Deb, aren't we the hardest working subcommittee? I think we have far more meetings than any other subcommittee.
And that's no joke. We truly are. We have more public hearings, and we certainly have more classified briefings. And it is because, Angus, it's such an important subcommittee. You know, our nuclear triad, our deterrence, our missile defense of this country, space as a warfighting domain, that's what we have jurisdiction over. And those areas truly form the bedrock for our national security. So it's extremely important. Every combatant commander, every military chief, they understand that without that deterrent, without our missile defense, our homeland's at risk. Our allies are also at risk. And so, yes, you and I, we take that responsibility very, very seriously. And I think the people of Maine, the people of this country, and I know I am extremely fortunate to have you as a partner, where we are pushing hard to make sure that we have the resources we need to defend our homeland.
And I think what's also important along those lines is that those military people, when they come before our committee, know that there's no free ride. They know that we're going to come at them, because part of our job, part of the job of in here in the Senate and in Congress is not very much talked about, but it's called oversight. And what it really means is that we get after the administration to be sure they're following the law and that their policy choices make sense. I think I said at a hearing recently to an admiral, what in the hell are you guys thinking? I won't go into the details on that. I think maybe it was classified. But the point is, we want to hold them to the law and hold them to good policy to defend the country. And that's an important function. I think many people overlook the role that Congress plays in dogging whatever the administration is to do the right thing.
Oh, I agree with you. Oversight's extremely important. And you did say, what the hell do you think you guys are doing? but, you
that
know,
was in
that's
a close session,
that's,
I think.
It was. But, you know, that is really important to make sure that we get the information we need. And it's up to the Department of Defense for them to really explain to us not just what they need, but why they need it. And for that, yes, we have to understand the threats to this country. I'm a Republican from Nebraska. You're an independent from Maine. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. As I said, we take our job on this very, very seriously, and we do push to get what we need to make sure our staff have access, that they have the proper credentials so that they can attend briefings too, because we have to have that information so we can make wise decisions.
Well, I think something I like about the subcommittee and the committee generally is if you were a stranger to this process and sat in on one of our hearings, I don't think you could tell who was of which party. And that's a
no.
good thing. And that's the way it should be. And I guess I'm going into this because I think the public should know that it's not all conflict and drama down here, that we do. There's a lot of important work that gets done. Well, let me go back just for a minute to paid family leave. Deb, thank you so much for your work on this. We don't know the timing. This is a funny place. The Senate is sort of like a train station that trains go through every so often, and you've got to be sure you get yourself on the train when it's going through the station. So we don't know when there'll be an opportunity to move this bill, but hopefully we're certainly going to stay at it. Maybe if there's a major tax bill later this year or next year, we'll be able to get that permanency that the program deserves.
I agree. We've got to find the train and we've got to hop on it.
Okay. Deb, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I enjoy working with you. You know that. And the people of Nebraska are fortunate to have somebody who is as dedicated as you are. So thanks so much for joining me. And thank you for being with us on Inside Maine. Stay with us, because we're going to be talking again about paid family leave, but from a point of view that you maybe don't often think about. Deb, again, thanks so much. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Maine. This is Angus King. We just talked to Deb Fischer, Republican Senator of Nebraska, who I have worked with over the past 5 or 6, actually more like 7 or 8 years, on paid family leave, a tax credit bill to encourage companies to provide family leave to their employees, particularly their employees who are frontline hourly workers.
And we're working on that bill to make it permanent. It was temporary when it was first passed. And we're trying to get to a place now in the next few months or perhaps early next year to move this bill into a permanent status so that more companies will take advantage of it. When most people think about paid family leave or family leave, they think about people with kids. They think about getting a sick kid from school or taking a child to the doctor. In this day and age, there's also a necessity, an importance, a significance for family leave for people to take care of their parents and their grandparents who may have a temporary problem or something that's more substantial. So today, I'm very glad to have join me in Maine, Drew Wyman, who is the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association in Maine and deals with these kinds of issues all the time. Drew, thanks so much for joining me on Inside Maine.
Oh, thank you, Senator King. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, let me start. I was really stunned by this figure. 29,600, almost 30,000 individuals in Maine are struggling with Alzheimer's. And when you multiply that by their family members, you're talking close to 100,000 people who are touched by this disease in Maine every day. Talk to me about the significance of family leave for the family of those who are afflicted with Alzheimer's.
Well, the typical caregiver for someone with Alzheimer's is a middle-aged working woman, and they're typically caring for a parent or an in-law, a parent-in-law. And many of these folks are in the sandwich generation, like 25% of them. And the earlier someone can get support, especially after a diagnosis, the better chance they have for planning. And that first diagnosis period is upsetting for the whole family, and you want to be able to plan ahead and think like, what are my options? Get some education. And so not having the distraction of, you know, working full time is a huge benefit just to enable that.
And so that the moment of diagnosis and the several weeks or months afterwards, that's when this would be important.
It's especially important because it would give an opportunity for a family member to be educated on their options and what they're about, you know, what they're facing and what they're dealing with, and talk with their loved one, the person they're providing support with. And like you said, the ripple effect to the other family members, friends, and their community, you could engage support in that regard and maybe have, you know, caregiving in place for longer term.
Well, we'll talk about family leave more, certainly, but give me a more general picture of Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's in Maine. Where I was amazed that there were almost 30,000 people afflicted, and then, of course, all the family members that are touched by it. But talk to me about this disease. It's one that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, people really didn't talk about it. They talked about senility and that kind of thing. But now we know we've got a serious disease on our hands.
You know, it's funny that you say that too, 30 or 40 years ago. That's exactly when I was affected as a kid, right? I was 10 years old when we had to take my grandmother into our home to care for her because, you know, she had progressed so far that she was unable to do activities of daily living. So my parents were working. And so in the summertime, my brother and I and other relatives would provide care for my grandmother at home. So yes, we've come a long way in 30 or 40 years and actually have person-centered care. We have education, we have resources, and we even have some treatments on the horizon. So that's exciting. In Maine, though, we say there's about 51,000 caregivers providing unpaid care. Now, there's a lot of families that don't even think of themselves as a caregiver. When I was 10 years old, I didn't think of myself as a caregiver, but I certainly, had I not been there, we would have had to bring in direct care or someone would have had to provide that care. So it's interesting because people might not identify that, say, oh, I'm not a caregiver, it's just my aunt. But you're visiting her three times a week and bringing food or helping someone with shopping. So you know, you're sort of like a satellite caregiver.
And the problem is, though, if you're working and your company doesn't have a paid family leave policy, you have to make a choice between going to take care of your aunt or your grandmother or mother and putting food on the table. I mean, that's what this law that we're talking about is all about.
And a lot of the caregiving in Maine falls onto family members, right? 83% of the help provided to older adults in the United States comes from family members. And 41% of those caregivers have a household income of less than $50,000. So they're not able to afford direct care. They're weighing those options. Is it cheaper for me to cut back my hours on work or to try to afford to bring in a direct care worker or a home health agency?
Wow. And that's where the burden falls. Well, one thing you mentioned just in passing a few minutes ago that I have to ask, and I'm sure our listeners are thinking about it. Well, where are we on figuring out this disease, either in terms of prevention or treatment? I remember meeting up in Bangor probably 10 years ago with people from Jackson Lab and the medical center, and nobody really had any answers at that point. Are we any closer?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing how much progress we've made in a short time. The fact that we have an FDA-approved treatment that attacks the underlying pathology of Alzheimer's now is huge, even though it's in the very preliminary stages. Think about where cancer was 30 or 40 years ago, and now there's over 200 FDA-approved drugs for cancer treatment. We're in the very beginning of that with Alzheimer's. We have a treatment that, if administered when caught very early in either the mild cognitive impairment stage or the very early stages of Alzheimer's, may have an effect to reduce progression. It's not going to reverse anything, or you're not going to get things back, but it will at least slow it down for a period of time. And that showed statistical significance in a body of clinical trials. So that's approved and people are getting those infusions, but it's going to be a slow rollout. But in terms of risk reduction and prevention, that's where the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. We've had a lot of lifestyle modification clinical studies that have shown up to 40% of cases could be reduced or avoided. And that's all the things. It's not surprising what it's diet, you know, nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress management, all of those kind of things that help reduce cases, maintaining your blood pressure, you know, watching for diabetes, all of that stuff.
Is there a difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? Is Alzheimer's a sort of more advanced case?
It's talk cause to me effect. About that too. Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's a really common one. So really, dementia is the term, the symptoms. It's the umbrella term. Alzheimer's is a cause. So dementia is the thing. Would be things like cognitive decline, short-term memory loss, confusion with time and space, all of those sort of symptomatic things, some behavioral stuff. But Alzheimer's is the most common cause that is diagnosed with really three hallmark biomarkers, amyloid plaques and tau tangles and inflammation. So there's other forms of dementia or other causes of dementia, like there's a vascular dementia that you've heard of, Lewy body dementia, which we know is what Bruce Willis has and Robin Williams had. And so there's a whole host of other things. A lot of people will have mixed dementia. A lot of people will die with a couple forms of dementia, but it's the symptoms that are, what we have to manage.
You sound pretty optimistic. And the fact that you can define it and talk about plaque in the brain and those kinds of things tells me that at least the scientists know what the target is.
Yeah. So you would diagnose it with a PET scan. So looking at amyloid plaques in the brain, amyloid fluid or a spinal tap. But now there's blood tests coming out that aren't quite ready for mainstream use or PCP use. But it's not that far off. And I think 30 years ago or 40 years ago, like you said, we thought, oh, this is senility, this is hardening of the arteries, or this is normal aging, which we now know it's not. It's a diagnosable, disease, a terminal illness. So we really have come a long way. And I think with the concern and awareness stuff, just like we're doing right now on this podcast, is fantastic because we're educating the public about these things that have been swept under the carpet for so long because there's a stigma and it's embarrassing to have cognitive decline or not be your sharp, smart self, which most people pride themselves on.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot because you mentioned a while ago there are things that you can do in terms of prevention. Give our listeners some advice.
Well, it's, regular exercise. It's the sort of stuff, what's good for your heart is good for your brain. So regular cardio workouts, learning, extended learning, learn a new skill. It's think of like going to the gym for your brain, learn a language, learn a musical instrument, learn, you know, push yourself a little bit, having that cognitive reserve.
Run for the U.S. Senate. So you have to be alert every day.
Right. You've got to be on your game, right?
Yes. Check with me first before you get that idea.
Okay.
But part of it, what I've noticed in my friends is those who remain engaged tend to age less. They have something to get up in the morning and do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I've noticed among people who I've known over the years, and those who remain engaged, they're firing on all cylinders. And if you sort of step back and sit in the wheel in the rocking chair, that's a problem, isn't it?
It, for sure. Social engagement's huge. We have a constituent that we work with that actually came down to DC with us this year for our forum. And he just ran the LA Marathon and he just qualified for the Boston Marathon. And he's in his mid-70s. He's unbelievable. He lives.
Doesn't he know that the first person to run a marathon died? I mean, come on. I've told Joni Benoit that, but thank goodness she never listened. Now here's something that I learned from a friend who's a physician, and that is that hearing loss can be a problem. That people who have progressive hearing loss, they're sort of checking out. And that can actually be a significant cause of dementia.
It is. Yeah, that stuff came out a couple of years ago. And I remember learning about that. They're, you know, checking out and disengaging socially, and they're not as stimulated, right? Like if you're stimulated in participating in conversations and interactions, that's going to help keep your brain sharp. So we're proponents of people getting their hearing tested and getting hearing devices, hearing aids, if that's what the doctor prescribes.
Yeah, and my mom didn't like to wear her hearing aids because she thought, you know, it made her look old or something. And that's a big mistake. Let me move back to the paid family leave piece, which is what we're wanted to focus upon. One of the aspects of this that people don't think about is that right now we're in a workforce crisis in the country and in Maine. We don't have enough workers. And so the paid family leave enables somebody to stay on the job and yet take care of the aunt or the grandparent. Otherwise, they might have to quit, and then we lose somebody out of the workforce.
Yeah, I was reading something about this, and the survey in California found more than 86% of the workers who took paid family medical leave came back to that same employer. So that's a huge benefit for the employer. As anyone knows, as I know, employee retention is huge because that's a burden on the employer if you end up losing multiple employees.
Well, I have to tell you, I have a lot of people visiting my office from Maine, and then I'm in Maine on the weekends. The number one thing I hear about, I hear a lot about inflation and housing, but the other piece is workforce. Mm. Not enough nurses, school superintendents, teachers, truck drivers. It's across the board. And so that's a hidden benefit of this law that Deb Fisher and I have worked on in order to keep people on the jobs. As you say, that's a very impressive number, the number that come back. And if they didn't have that, they'd probably have to quit all if they didn't have the support for the temporary leave to take care of the family member, they might never come back.
Right. And the loyalty to a company or having a cohesive staff. I mean, we always say here, you can replace a position, but you can't replace a person, especially with a smaller organization. I mean, we have a tiny little staff of six of us, and everybody's personality has an influence on the whole. And so if you were to remove one and replace a person, it changes the whole dynamic. And I think, I mean, small businesses must face that too, but even in small departments.
There's also if you have a lot of turnover, there's a lot of expense in training and retraining. And retention is what it's all about, and that's why I think this bill that Deb and I we got passed in 17, mm-hmm. but there hasn't been as much uptake on it as we had hoped because it wasn't permanent. The employers said, "Well, we don't want to provide a benefit and then have the tax credit go away, and then we're stuck in the situation of perhaps having to take away something. That's right. Not good for employee morale. So our big push this year and into next year, as soon as possible, is to make this a permanent law. Well, listen, you've given me a little bit of optimism today about the pursuit of a cure, and it is one of the most devastating diseases. I've had friends and have close family friends, and it's so difficult. And the idea that we can A, do something about preventing it, but also delay it or make the symptoms not so severe.
Well, it's exciting. At the end of July, we have our Alzheimer's Association International Research Conference in Philadelphia. And so I'll be going down to that. And I love that because, you know, hope is in the research, right? And we'll have folks from the Jackson Lab there and like over 5,000 researchers from around the globe. And what's amazing is people are sharing data. So even failed clinical trials yield something, you know, let's not continue down that path. And researchers are amazing at sharing their work. And it's inspiring to see how many people are dedicated to this.
I predict when you get there, there's going to be a lot of talk about AI. Artificial intelligence can actually be a boon and not a risk, because you can run simulations in the blink of an eye that otherwise would have taken months.
Yeah, there's talk about that. And I'm sure there'll be some poster presentations on what's being done with AI to accelerate research. But that's anything we can do to compress time is helpful.
Let me know what you hear on that front, because we're coping with AI down here, trying to figure out how to take advantage of the potential, but also deal with some of the risks that it poses. Well, listen, Drew, I really appreciate the time you've taken with us, and I'm delighted. I believe that the Alzheimer's Association is in support of our bill, and that's a good thing, and we will continue to work on it. I just, as I say, finished a conversation with Deb Fisher, who's my lead co-sponsor on this, and the fact that we got it through the first time is a good sign. Just have to wend our way through the process.
Right.
Down here, but we're going to continue to work on it. And I hope you'll stay in touch, because this affects, and just the number of people with the disease is just the beginning of its impact. Drew, thank you so much. And thanks for the work that you do. It's really important to so many people and families in Maine. And I look forward to continue to work with you as we, and one of the things we got to do is research. We got to keep funding the NIH so that we can do the research at places like Jackson Lab and other places around the country. So let's keep at it.
Yes, and that's exactly right, that we were at $400 million research funding for many years, and now at the NIH level, thanks to people like you, we are at $3.8 billion a year and hopefully growing it every year. So just that change in the last decade has been hopeful and inspiring.
We're going to get there. Thanks so much. Great to talk to you. Keep in touch.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being with us on Inside Maine. We've been talking about paid family leave, and in the last section, talking about Alzheimer's with Drew Wyman, the executive director of the Alzheimer's Association chapter in Maine, about that disease and how family leave not only is about children, but it's also about parents and grandparents and family members who are afflicted with dementia and diseases like Alzheimer's, and why it's important to press forward on legislation that will assist real people, frontline workers, in not having to make a decision between putting food on the table and taking care of a sick relative, but will enable them to do both. Thanks again for being with us on Inside Maine. See you next time. This is Angus King.